Well, we did attend the Pre-Trib Research Center, now it's called. Used to call the Pre-Trib Study Group. It has been going on now for 23 years. That's long enough for somebody to actually grow up. 23 years. It's a long time. 1990. What would it be? 1991, 92? So I'll tell you about things. I have Dwight Pentecost's picture up here, Things to Come author, died this last year, 99. So I guess it's good to have these teaching jobs because you just live forever. You're soft and cushy. So, anyway, we'll talk a little bit about our eschatology. So if you have questions, we'll kind of handle those as we go along. And there is a theological issue that I went with, and when I got there, I found out it was sort of discussed and something we discussed here. So we'll make that our theological high point. When you come to the pre-trib research information or theology, pre-trib theology, one of the presenters, Paul Wilkinson from England, reminded us that we can get so involved in the details of his coming, the details of the eschatology, we forget about who's coming. Now, that was probably a good reminder that, you know, it's going to be the pre-trib rapture, all that. But we got to remember the Lord is coming. And the details of when and so forth have to be kept in perspective. That was a good reminder. Well, the Pre-Trib Research Center started with Tim LaHaye in 1991. I'll just read this because he wrote this, or somebody did. Became concerned about a perceived swaying from the pre-tribulational doctrine. In 1992, Dr. LaHaye released his book on the rapture, No Fear of the Storm, from Multnomah. It was re-released in 1998 as Rapture Under Attack. In the process of preparing the first edition of his rapture book, Dr. LaHaye was impressed with the gathering of the Albury, Park, and Powers Court conferences in Britain. If you know anything about the birth of dispensationalism, we know you will recognize those names as places where this stuff was hammered out, or at least there was a meetings about this in England, Britain. And that was during the late 1820s and 1830s, where leaders gathered to discuss issues relating to the Bible prophecy. Dr. LaHaye contacted Tommy Ice, and he called me, he's Tommy because he's from the South, and discussed the possibility of calling a similar meeting for December 1992. This meeting came about in Dallas with about 30 top prophetic or prophecy scholars, authors, and populists participating in the three-day event. The group adopted the title of Pre-Trib Study Group, which I just mentioned. Dr. LaHaye was elected chairman, no surprise, of the steering committee, and Dr. Ice, the vice chairman. And so it's been going under that flagship for these 23 years and is still doing a very nice job of bringing issues before the public at the conference, and then having a visible site on the web where you can read papers that address the defense of pre-tribulationalism, which seems like it ought not have to be defended. But there is, of course, always an attack on the truth. So that's kind of the conference background. There's probably, I never know, I guess 200, 300 people there. And it's always about the same. Last few years has been about the same number of people. There are always some new ones that come and some old ones that you say, oh, well, so-and-so wasn't there this year. And it's kind of enjoyable for us because we get to know people from another part of the country and find about their ministry and so forth, and make even some friends with people that are in Europe, which is to know that Lord works there too. So what we do on the weekend, we usually visit a church on Sunday. This last time we went to the First Baptist of Dallas, Texas. Do you remember Jerry Zimmerman used to play our organ here? He and Sharon, that's their home church. It's also Charles Ryrie's home church where he goes. So we visited there, and I'll show you pictures of that in a minute. Monday we have conference. All day, it's an intensive day, 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock at night, with a banquet with a keynote speaker. They always have a banquet; it's kind of a nice thing, and they have a little bit of special music, and you know, kind of like you would at the banquet. And they have a speaker that comes in that's, I don't say popular, but, you know, a good speaker. So Robert Jeffress is the pastor there. You see, in fact, I saw him last night on Riley. If anybody saw him last night. So he's a Fox News contributor. Does a pretty good job of defending Christianity, and especially against Islam. And he's a no-nonsense guy when it comes to seeing it how it is. So it's a little refreshing. And the conference is on Tuesday, same deal. In the evening, there's a kind of a panel event, not really papers. And then Wednesday, we just go to noon, then we get on the car and head home. And while you were in class here last week, if you came, we were probably somewhere around Salina, so on the way home. So there are 10 papers, maybe 12, and there was a little different this year. There's not one person actually got up and read their paper. You know, they just presented their material. Some of it was in paper form. A lot of it was in PowerPoint form. And those PowerPoints are, you know, they sent them home with us. There's a few of them that did not have them, so I have nothing. Maybe I'll have something when they actually produce the literature for the conference. So these are papers presented by authors, pastors. I call them professional people that actually live their life in doing this work, either as a pastor or as a teacher or as an author. And some of them are in other aspects of life, financial aspects, diplomatic corps sometimes. We also have the White House correspondent comes. He presents on Tuesday night some material from what we can learn from what goes on at the White House these days, or any day. He's been there for a number of years. The conference is turned into pretty much, I'd say, a popularized version of it, of a conference, so we don't have people read 40 pages, you know, in a monotone, which kind of can't put you to sleep. I never minded that because I was interested in the subject, so now it's a little more popularly presented by the people. I did mention that we were First Baptist. It's quite a project, and it's $130 million. It's a church where W. Criswell was pastor, and before him this guy named Truett. And they had to destroy a whole city block, which they owned, in order to build their new building. And it's quite something. You go in there, and we watched the service, and I didn't pick this spot to sit, but we're sitting right behind the control center, and I thought it's kind of funny, the Victory in Jesus, that's a Southern Baptist song. I think they must sing it at every service. And they sang at that service too. And you see the screens in front there. And we just have two screens, and they have the whole panorama screens. And where we were sitting there, see if I can do this for you. The orchestra comes up off the floor, you know. And you watch them, they're going up. And while they're doing that, the choir's coming in the back. And so, you know, I'll just stop it there. I remind myself, I'm not at home here. I'm in Dallas, Texas, where there's a lot of money. A lot of money. And I thought, well, what do these people supposed to do, hide their money or act like they don't have any? And then I came home and said, well, you know, our paltry $2.5 million project might look like something ostentatious to the person that comes from Western Nebraska, walks out of a church of 40 people or 20, and don't even have an overhead projector. So I think, you know, everything is kind of in perspective relationship to where you are. But anyway, I think it's their church. They're enjoying it. That auditorium wasn't as big as I thought. It says it only seats 3,000. You know, we seat 1,500, so half of that. So, but a lot of money. And it's a good church in terms of it's dispensational, and the pastor's outspoken. They probably might tend to be a little more political than we would be. In fact, yesterday he was at the Senate praying the opening prayer for the Senate. Not that that's a political event, but he would encourage politics more. But I'm not sure what he means by that, because I think we should be standing up for what's right and be against what's wrong. And sometimes that becomes political, whether it's abortion or whatever's out there. You know, we just don't say, well, since that's a political affair, we just don't talk about it. I say, well, that's not the way the Christians should act, because we're supposed to stand for the truth. Whether I form community organizations to oppose something, I'm not sure we need to do that. And I'm not sure they do that. So anyway, this is the group that we go down with. Every year it's a little bit different, but Tommy Ice and his wife Janice, and back, we remember we had him here in my science class about a year ago, and in right front of me is Tommy's sister. She's from Virginia. And then we have, on Janice's right, your left, we have a couple and two ladies, three ladies. They're from the Omaha area. There's actually four ladies. They were part of the church where Tommy was in Omaha before he went back to Dallas. And then we have the man in the red shirt is Johannes Vogel, who is a German schoolmaster. He has the only pre-trib school in Europe. And I was going to write him, email him, verify again how many students he has. I think he said 40. And so they actually teach pre-trib, and they have the little pre-trib conference like we do in Dallas for the people in Europe. And then in front of them is the man in the tall with the dark jacket, Paul Wilkinson, was the man that reminded us about that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that Jesus is coming, and don't worry too much about the details. You know, don't let the details of his timing overshadow the fact that he is coming. And Nick Dem is his pastor's son who goes with him. He's got a learning disability, so he kind of follows around and kind of observes, and I don't know what else it is that he's there for, but he always comes and is part of the group. The lady in the plaid and the polka dot skirt, her husband, now deceased, but invented the Big Bertha Golf Club. So if you ever, I know there is such a thing. I guess it must be a big one. Is that what it is? A big club? Okay. So I guess she probably is well fixed, since everybody knows about the Big Bertha. My wife's mother was named Bertha, so it's not very kind on her. But no association. Well, the middle of the night, we got this fire alarm. We had to get up and get out of the building because there was a fire alarm. I just thought that was kind of funny. And we were out there. We meet this Johann Vogel. He was standing out there in the cold like we were. So anyway, there we are waiting for us to get the go ahead to go back in the building. Nothing to the conference. This is that school that's in Germany, northeastern Germany. If you know where Cologne is, maybe you don't. It's on the western side. A little bit northeast of Cologne is where the school is. And you see, it's a nice facility. And I asked them, well, how do you fund this thing? So, well, the students pay a tuition, and the government pays the students the tuition to go to the school. So in Europe, you think, well, they wouldn't allow someone to go to a Christian school and have the government pay for it. Well, yeah, that's part of the system. So the government pays them to go to the Christian school. That would never happen here. And we're the ones that have a separation of church and state, but they don't. So somehow that works for them. It's a really nice facility, and he's a very, very nice man. He speaks good English, so we get along really fine. Okay, I just mentioned about White Pentecost, Things to Come book, probably one of the best books on prophecy from dispensational point of view. You know, Tim LaHaye, he is now almost 89. I keep telling my friends that I got to get myself some younger ones. This is the room in which the conference occurs, and obviously nobody in there. That's why I could go in front and take a picture. Charles Ryrie is now, he is 89 years old, and you carry the Bible that he wrote. Yeah, you got that. But anyway, he's still living, and he was Gilt's teacher at Philadelphia College of the Bible. And our daughter Carrie said he was up at Moody one time when she was there and said, you know, what a boring teacher he is. And I heard that. Very, very dry. So some of these guys know a lot and can say a lot of things, but they don't necessarily present it in a very attractive way. Here's Robert Jeffress, pastor of the Dallas First Baptist. Okay, so the byline is making sense of current events. So you sort of, the conference opening lecture by Tommy was trying to thread the needle about how do we look at current events. And that's what I want to talk to you about, because that's what we were talking about when we quit our series. Are we so bold to say that prophecy is being fulfilled today or not? If not, why not? Or if it is, how do we explain it? Because we know somehow the church's imminent, return of Christ for the church is imminent, and there can be no signs for that. So how do we make sense of all this? And I think that's probably where this title comes from. So let me walk through this idea. I was going to mention this too. If you want to see some good articles, it's just this pretrib.org. is where you get these articles, and all these papers that have been presented over these years are online, and you can download and you can read them. So it's not like, and they don't cost anything. You don't have to join anything to see them. So it's just pretrib.org, and if you lose track of the name, just ask me, and I'll give it to you again. All right, so there's Tommy with the microphone. All right. So the question about how do we deal with this question about fulfilled prophecy, and maybe I'm not going to do this the way it ought to be done, but you know, I got to start somewhere. I'm going to start this way. First of all, historicism. We've talked about that here before. Historicism means that people believe that, well, let me just read this. I'll get all balled up. Historicism is the first of the post-Reformation attempts to make sense of the lost scripture, the scriptures that were lost because of Augustine. Augustine says this is allegorical, and when the scriptures are allegorical, they're nonsensical. You learn nothing from allegory because you don't know what it means. So in the post-Reformation period, remember 1518, actually about 1535, when Henry VIII, where do I have Henry VIII up there? Here we have Henry VIII, chained the Bible to the pulpits in England for about 2 years and said people, since now the Pope is now the head of the church, that the Bible should have authority in the church. And well, the people need to know what the Bible says, so he put the Bible in the hands of the people. That was sort of like opening the latch on the door, and the people started reading it, and they found out that many of the promises that God made to the Jews have not been fulfilled. All right. But we entered at that page a period of time called historicism. They're trying to make sense of this period after Augustine. So historicists saw the church in the tribulation and interpreted Revelation, the first chapters 2 to 4, 6 through 19, as being fulfilled sequentially in the church age. So I have this up on the board over here. Historic post-millennialism starts here with Henry VIII. Historicism really is post-millennialism. So on the board I've got on my screen here, we have the church is in the tribulation. You see, this is different than what you or what I teach. I don't know what you believe. I hope you believe this. Don't believe this. So church is in the tribulation. There's no rapture here. And this tribulation stretched through the whole church age. In order to do that, you allegorize things, spiritualize things like the 7 years, because all of a sudden 7 years now means, well, it's almost 2,000 years. They believe in a second advent, that the Lord is going to come back in the second advent. They do not believe in a separate tribulation year or 7 years for Israel or at all. They also don't know what to do with the rapture. So they put the basic could say, well, they don't believe in the rapture. And they'd say, good, I don't want to believe in the rapture. They want to believe in one return. And if the rapture is included, it's at the return of the Lord. Somehow, he comes up and he comes back down. You know, like, if you have to have a rapture, that's where they put it. So it becomes post-tribulational rapture of the church, premillennial. So the name we give that is historic premillennialism. Not historicism, historic premillennialism. It's historic because it goes back to what it was like here, before Augustine. It's historic premillennialism. All right, so that's historicism, that prophecy now is being fulfilled in the entire church age. Okay, next step. Now, it says consistent futurism on the top, but that's because that's the article that it comes from. But what Tommy is saying here is he's still describing historicism. Thus, according to mainstream historicism, the events of Revelation 4 through 19 have pretty much all taken place in church history. What I just said, it's being fulfilled in the church history. Proponents of this view are mainly waiting for Armageddon, which is just before the second coming, or at the second coming. So the key point that will arise in this, according to Tommy Ice's series, which he's writing, which this is a part of, is that historicism believes that the events of the tribulation period are being fulfilled in the church age. Now, you might recognize this, as I already have mentioned, you may recognize this as historic premillennialism. So we don't get the historicism and historic mixed up, but they are related. Okay, now futurism, which is what we are, hopefully, futurism thinks about the future. Which way is the future? Whatever, the future. Futurism, a correction to historicism. Remember, it's out here. Historicism was first. Dispensational premillennialism follows it. And I know that at this point we have competing ideas of historic premillennialism competing with this, but it goes back to this and it goes back to that. So this is where too many people are these days, but this is the drift that it's gone, postmillennialism, post-tribulationalism. But what we're talking about, which is pure futurism or consistent futurism, is dispensational premillennialism. So a correction of historicism, the church age Bible literature, I worked on this to make sure I said it right. The church age Bible literature, that's in our book, Bibles in the New Testament, can't say the Gospels, church age literature makes no prophetic utterance for the church that expects it to happen in the age of the church. It talks about prophecy for the church. It talks about the rapture. It talks about the Antichrist. But we find nothing within the church age. So that's why we're called futurists, because we say everything is in the future. So on the bottom of this chart, we have what is probably known in your sleep, the church, the rapture, the tribulation, second advent, the millennial kingdom. Now, in this case, we have literal Jewish promises remain in the church age. They don't go away. The rapture is this thing coming of Christ. It's not to earth. It comes in the air to gather the church together. And we have the tribulation where he gathers his Jews together, finishes that work, and then returns, and he plants his feet on the Mount of Olives and sets up this earthly kingdom. And the kingdom has a Jewish character, and it does include Israel. So there are some differences here on that last one I showed you. So Jewish prophecy, all prophetic fulfillment, is inside the 70th week. Futurism says that all prophetic fulfillment is within the 7th week of Daniel. So now we have a little bit of a problem about fulfilled prophecy. When I said that all prophecy is within the 7th week of Daniel, so we have to sort of, I don't want to use the word monkey around, but we have to use some terms here to explain what we're saying, because that really isn't quite true, what I said. So fulfilled prophecy, so we come up with, and they use the word a lot, the setting the table for fulfilled prophecy. Now, it is hard, maybe impossible, to accept the rule that no prophecy, and I said no prophecy, occurs during the church age. It's hard to say that there's no prophecy ever fulfilled in the church age, because I can point you to some things that have happened. For example, for 483 years, that's the 69 weeks of years, ended A.D. approximately 33 at the cross. However, Jesus' prophecy, using Daniel 7:24-27, regarding the destruction of the temple, happens in the church age. Let's say 37 years after the cross, well into the church age at 70 A.D. And then, more yet, the scattering of the Jews to the nations, especially from 132 A.D. at the Bar Kokhba rebellion, with the emptying of Jerusalem of the Jews and the destruction of the city to its foundations, which is also prophesied in the Bible. So now I've got a problem, because I say all of these prophecies have to occur within the 7th week of Daniel. Well, I'm outside the 7th week of Daniel. I'm in the gap period. So Jewish fulfillment in the church age violates the strict rule of maintaining all prophecy inside the 7th week of Daniel. They don't even want, there shouldn't even be any between in the gap period, because it should be in the weeks. So an accommodation is saying that these are transitional events, point of view. There's sections that are transition, and I can accept that. I think that's probably a good explanation. There's a transition to the church age. It lasted 30, 40 years, because when Apollos was confronted by Aquila, is that who it was, Apollos and Aquila, and they said, well, we hadn't even heard about the Spirit. You know, they'd heard about John the Baptist's baptism, but never heard about the Spirit baptism. I think I got the right people there. So they were then brought into the church 30 years after, probably 30 years after the church was formed, or maybe 20, 25 years, I forget, would be middle of 55. So we have these transitional periods that occur in Scripture when things are gearing up or leaving off. So that doesn't bother me. I'm just looking for the right kind of terminology to express this. Now that's at the other, now at the back end, or close to us, the year, 1948, with the modern state of Israel. By the way, Tommy is writing this, who presented a paper about being consistent futurists. In 1948, with the modern state of Israel was born, it not only became an important stage-setting development, but began an actual fulfillment of specific biblical or Bible prophecies. And we're outside the seventh week, okay? It's an international gathering of the Jews and unbelief before the judgment of the tribulation. So I think that we're using these words, little, not say loose, but we got to be careful so we understand how we're using them so we don't get ourselves trapped. So here we have this conundrum. The top is the church. Top line is the church. Well, it starts at the cross, 50 days after the cross. And it continues on up until the rapture. Okay, so after the church starts, there is a period of transition. It's in this period where we have the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem and the scattering of the people. So we have a transition over here. It's not inside the seventh week of Daniel. It's outside. It's in the church age. It's fulfillment of Jewish prophecy in the church age. And we have the same thing going on here. So we have fulfillment of Jewish prophecies are outside seventh week of Daniel. Okay? All right, and here I got some things. I think what I'm going to do is blow this section up on the next slide. So it seems like Now we have, in this section, it seems to me like, the way I've been teaching it, we have a regathering, which is out of Ezekiel 38, 36 through 39, that section, regathering, first of all, in unbelief. I think then we have the rapture, which follows. And then we have the Gog and Magog war, which I think follows the rapture, so I got these sort of in sequence. Then we have the peace accord, which actually starts the tribulation. But all of these are outside of the seventh week of Daniel. But I think that they are all prophetically significant events as it relates to the Jews, except the rapture, because it's for the church. Okay. Now, another thing that's sort of a fulfillment thing, this, in order for Israel to sign a peace agreement with Antichrist, guess what? They have to exist in the land. So there is a somewhat of a tacit admission that there has to be a nation that's already a fulfillment of prophecy, and it's not in the seventh week of Daniel yet. Okay. Are you following me? I hope you are. So I think we have two ways of looking at this. So I call it the hard fulfillment of prophecy. The regathering of Israel as hard fulfillment of prophecy is hard to or impossible to deny based on line and verse of Scripture. In other words, it just seems like Tommy I said, it is a fulfillment of prophecy. It's not stage setting. It is fulfillment of prophecy. True, it may be denied that the 1948 regathering is not the equal Ezekiel regathering, which happened when it first happened. I remember people would say, well, they're in the land now, but I'm not sure they're to stay. They could be out again 20 times. But if you read your scriptures carefully, they're not in and out of the land 20 times. It says when they come back to the land, which seems to be this time, was the next time from when it was written, they won't leave. So they're there to stay. So I think that the regathering 1948 is that Ezekiel passage. Now, if you say, no, I don't think it is, well, then at least you're consistent. You can deal with the consistency. There's no prophecy in the church age at the 1948 period, but you still haven't dealt with the 70 AD and 132 age period when that is within the church age, and it is a fact because it's happened. Can't be denied. So I say if you allow one in the church age, you have room to allow another. Now be careful here. You know, you don't want to be able to have a licensor to do whatever you want with it. Okay, so paragraph number three, the fact that Israel can sign a peace accord with the Antichrist starting the tribulation, which is outside the seventh week of Daniel, their forming has to be outside the seventh week, supposes that a viable nation has been reestablished, a fulfillment of prophecy. Add the destruction of the temple in 70 AD makes for a list of hard fulfillment of prophecy in the church age. So I think there's hard fulfillment of prophecy in the church age. Now, how about this to call it soft fulfillment of prophecy? My definition of soft fulfillment is there is a soft fulfillment of prophecy when there is no this is that event. You know, the Bible says this, and it's that pointing to something in our day. Therefore, it does not refer to a specific prophetic event, nor does it deal with anything in absolute time. And its time always has to be tied to a fulfilled prophecy. My example, and I thought probably not a very good one, but we a lot of times hear that there's apostasy in the church. It is the sign of the time, or it is fulfillment of prophecy. I don't happen to agree with that, so I should have used a different example, but let's just use it for fun. Apostasy in the church is a soft fulfillment of prophecy, 1 Timothy 1:4. Don't have to use 2 Timothy 2:2, which is, talks about the apostasia, which I think is the rapture. I'm not going to use that one. Use Timothy 1:4. See, the apostasy in the church is a soft fulfillment of prophecy. It is, since it is not related to a specific time on the clock. However, when the apostasy is considered as a fulfillment of prophecy, it must refer to this is that event on the clock. If the church suffers tribulation, soft, it must not conclude that it is the tribulation period. Because the tribulation period is a defined period. It will start with the Antichrist signs the covenant with Israel. Then it starts. See, it's a time-based thing. So we got to be careful. I got an email today, and they found out that it was a messed up hoax, I guess you might say, that something was a soft fulfilled prophecy. And so I was going to use it in my class tonight. So here's an example of a soft fulfillment, but it wasn't. It was a hoax. I can't use it. But so we got to be careful how we talk about fulfilled prophecy. The apostasy, for one thing, how in the world would you ever measure an apostasy as a hard fact, a hard prophecy? Wouldn't it start? Give me a date. Give me a time on the clock. When did it start? Well, it's just a period of time. Okay, now we're talking softness. And I say apostasy in the church has always gone on. Have you ever? It was already rampant in the church when Paul writes. So it's not a sign of the times, of the end times. It is a sign of the times. And we're always in the end times in the church age. You know, I don't even know that it is a soft prophecy because I know that some of these people would start counting, and they would have at the conference. There would be some of those that would have counted. See, the earthquake numbers are going up, which probably isn't true. But they look at these things, volcanoes, unrest. These are all signs of the time. I said, well, okay, as long as you don't say that these are signs of the latter day times that we say, you know, today, but they weren't there before. So I don't think so. I think they're the time, they're the signs of the last days, which we're in the whole church age. Because you can't say this is that. It just is volcanoes. You know? All right. So I give you two choices. You always like choices. Your choices are this. Behind door number one is door number two. First of all, recognize fulfillment of prophecy in the church age only for Israel. Recognize fulfillment of prophecy in the church age, allow it in the church age, but it's only for Israel. Now, can I look across the fence, see what God's doing with Israel, and kind of determine what's going on? Of course. But it's not conditioned on the, you know, those things are something I observe. I don't, you know, I can't bank anything else on it except I just observe it. I've said this to you not too long ago in 1948 when Israel was formed as a nation. as a younger person, I would never guess that it would be at least 66 years before the rapture would occur. Well, see, I'm looking at Israel and making some guesses. Well, the Lord is still waiting 66 years away. You know, he's postponing his judgment is really what he's doing. So for that, we should be glad. So recognize fulfillment of prophecy in the church age only. This renders a strong apologetic argument. You know, that you can look in the Bible and you see in our age, if you live since 1948, you see in your lifetime, prophecy has been fulfilled. Not this soft kind of stuff. No, real, bona fide, hardcore prophecy that God says is going to happen. You can go to the calendar and put your finger on the date when it happened. And you can go to Israel and see the effect of it even today. All right. Then it puts pause in covenant theology. And some of us have been reading Mike Locke's book on displacement theology. And not every so there are some people that have noticed this. We don't seem to see it in our circles, but some of the liberal theologians see this reestablishment of Israel as a nation in these days and wonder about that. Did we miss something here? So it is a strong apologetic. Or, and this is where it is somewhat with the church today, the liberal church, or it makes skeptics angry that Israel has the audacity to claim old promises. Israel ought to relinquish the land claims to the Palestinians. And that was talked about quite a bit at the conference, how much anti-Semitism there is in the intellectual circles, especially in the schools, in the colleges, universities. So they say, if it is, and now the Christians are doing it. And I got a Mennonite background. The Mennonites are banging away on this, especially the old Mennonites, the kind that are out at Milford and out east in Elkhart, Indiana. They're very, very anti-Semitic people. Breaks my heart. Okay. So if they recognize these prophecies for Israel in the church age, that's fine. And these are the reasons it helps. Or you can accommodate these events as table-setting events, and that's the word they use for fulfilled prophecy. Well, this works well for a coming prophecy, but not well for traditional, transitional events in the church in the beginning of the church age, because those aren't hardly table-setting prophecies, since we're maybe, when you're done eating, you take the stuff off the table, you know, unsetting the table. Maybe we'll call it that. So I think the fear here is, on the part of the futurists, consistent futurists, the reason for the insisting that all prophecy is fulfilled in Daniel's 70th week is the fear of slipping into historicism. And when you slip into historicism, you slip towards covenantalism. Now, here, this is a little thing that you probably know about, too. You can avoid one side of the bridge so hard that you back off the other side, which means you're better off staying in the middle somewhere. I don't mean middle, soggy middle, but, you know, just to be careful that we don't overreact to this. So I think we have a place to be able to say, a way to say that prophecy is being fulfilled today, but it's for Israel and not for the church. And I can say, yes, it's filled outside of the seventh week of Daniel for Israel. The seventh week of Daniel, the church is never in any of the Daniel passages. It starts after the Daniel passage, and it exits before it commences again in the gap. So that's it. So I really think that's the fear here, that the futurists, consistent futurists, just don't want to give any space here that we have prophecy outside the seventh week, because it opens the door for more fulfillment of prophecy, which would be things like you said, Larry. Maybe we start thinking of the earthquakes, and you know, I mentioned to you Fruitenbaum's idea that World War I or World War II, or according to him, were signs of things that are in the church age that actually point to Israel. And so you add these things to it, and that's what he holds. So, but and that's the worry. Now you're going to add more things to it than you should, and pretty soon you slide into covenantalism, which is not good. All right, I knew that would take a while. Is there any question about this? No, if they started building a temple in Jerusalem tomorrow, it wouldn't change my theology one bit, or my eschatology. It doesn't have anything to do with the church. See, that's what I think we're making the distinction here is, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what else is going to happen. I would think that if the Antichrist, I mean, if there's going to be an Antichrist takes over the temple in the middle of the tribulation, I guess they could build it real quick. But in some sense, you could say the way my scenario works, you have the rapture, the Gog and Magog, and then you got a period of time in there where they could start rebuilding the temple before the tribulation starts. So they could, that thing could be up and running before the signing of the temple contract with the for peace. Yeah, I don't think there's any problem with that. Yeah, in the back. And it could be outside the 70th week of Daniel. Right. That's what I'm arguing for, if that's the right word here. I'd say there's hard fulfillment of prophecy outside the 7th week of Daniel. I give you two or three, and there may be others that we don't know about. But when it's all said and done, it will be there, like just, for example, that. But I'm the last guy who wants to be covenant. I mean, I don't want to fall off that side of the bridge like I'm going to do this all the way, you know. I'm going to back up, but I'm not going to back off the other side of the bridge. Well, I'll tell you, the rest of this, I don't know for sure what to do with these. I got a few things I want to share with you, but they're not easy to share with you because when somebody gets up and talk for an hour and a half and I'll put that all together in a brief statement, I got to be better than they are. You know, but I'll give you some efforts here. This is Andy Woods. He's a lawyer, PhD, theologian. Anyway, smart guy, tall guy, 6'8" or whatever. So he's talked about world government on the horizon, and that was sort of the stage-setting idea, is the world government pointers in the direction of world government. And we say, yeah, but is it hard fulfillment? No. I'm not even sure soft fulfillment yet, but we just know that there's going to be one world government. So when we see things that are happening in the world that are pointing to one world government, we better not say fulfill prophecy. You know, somebody say with signs of the times. Okay, that's fine. You know, there are signs out there that are, but they're not fulfilled prophecy. So he came up with this, and I call these soft fulfillment here. He comes up with 7 points. One is the elitist thinking, and if you're involved at all with what's going on in the world today, you know there's an awful lot of our culture is being shaped by elitist thinking somewhere. The general population are not coming with these great grandiose ideas how things ought to be in the ideology. So they're coming out of these think tanks, and they are very, very powerful because they're speaking with one voice. And that side never worries about how much they're going to get done in 1 year. All they're trying to do is keep the pressure on for it to change. So they're happy with incrementalism, you know. So they're happy for these small victories in different places because in the aggregate, everybody pushes a little bit, like the boa constrictor snake. As long as he gives in a little bit somewhere, they're making progress. So you have the elitist thinking. And by the way, this elitist thinking totally is void of any consideration for God and his revelation. In fact, they see Christianity as the enemy of their thought. So you have elitist thinking, and then it fits into the educational system, which goes from, you know, I'm not into politics. I don't mean to be into politics, but we have the governmental system now wants to dictate from Washington what's taught in schools. Why would they want to do that? Because they can control the curriculum. That goes with the elitist thinking. People have to be told what to think. Now we're moving towards, away from God, towards a human system. And we have different things that they use to affect this management by crisis, you know, get everybody stirred up so that you think the sky's going to fall in. Well, the sky's going to fall in. We're open to any solution. And the Gaia hypothesis, which is environmentalism, that we would serve the earth, you know, and we have to do everything to preserve our place. And I'll give you some more stuff on this later on the next paper, I think it is, about that. So I'll skip it for now. The issues of the Supreme Court, you know, they have no Judeo-Christian concerns. They're now looking across the river or across the ocean to see what other countries are doing and what's morally right over there we ought to be doing over here. It has nothing to do with the Constitution. Then we have unmanageable national debt, which is a sort of almost like it seems to be planned for. You know, you put us at the mercy of somebody else, and it's also another way to level the playing field. It, You know, it supposedly knocks down the rich people and helps the poor, but as it ends up, it helps the rich people and hurts the poor. And we have spiritual ecumenism, which is, you know, the idea that we all spiritually serve together. Well, this is all rooted in Daniel 7:23, and he said the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom. We just had this last, well, no, we don't have this one yet. On the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, tread it down and crush it. So there is this prophetic statement about an oncoming world government. This is what some of the people have said about this idea of unity of humanity. Just as you know, just as we know or should know that none of our domestic problems can be solved within the artificial boundaries of states, so none of our global problems can be solved within the large artificial boundaries of the nations. In other words, we need to knock down the boundaries of our nations and get together one global effort. Some even believe that we are part, this is David Rockefeller, even some believe we are part of the secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterize my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it. So what's it trying to do? The Humanist Manifesto, 1973. Some of these things are amazing how old they are. We deplore the division of humankind on nationalistic grounds. We have reached a turning point in human history where the best option is to transcend the limits of national sovereignty and move towards the building of a world community, a system of world law, world order based on transnational federal government. So now we got the signs of the time. I don't say we have fulfilled the prophecy here. So then we have this Gaia. You know, Gaia is the Mother Earth God. Mark Muser, some of you maybe have read some of his books, Nazi Oaks, this book. We have it back there. It's a very good book. Pantheism means that God is everything and man is strictly a part of nature, not above it. So we have God and humanity merging together and you find nature in the middle. Well, take time for that. Modern environmentalists often blame the Judeo-Christian worldview for separating man from nature. That's true. We are not nature. So the Judeo-Christian view separates man from nature. They deplore that. Environmentalism is a totalitarian movement because of its emphasis on mutual independence designed to save the planet through all-encompassing holistic solutions. You get this reoccurring theme. We have to get together to solve our problems. If we don't, we will die. That's an emergency thing. Modern environmentalism promotes lawlessness. You know, we see that. Through the holistic nature-based ethos that reduces people down to brute realm of nature. Modern environmentalism is an apocalyptic movement designed to scare people into drastic political actions. What do you see? Those Statue of Liberty is underwater. I just feel so bad for her. The oceans are rising. We must do something quickly before she drowns. Nature cannot survive Christianity. Nature cannot survive Christianity. It always comes back to Christianity is the attack. Anthropocentrism is man is the center. That they use it like that's what we are, because we say man's the center of nature and God made the world for man. So they call that's a negative. And a negative thing for man is the capitalistic industry that we care for ourselves. We produce and value the work that we do, and we support our families by doing this. So we see that the ozone layer is to the left and the carbon dioxide layer is to the right. We're doomed. You know, and so humanity is standing on the nature balance or tipping the scale. So humans must go. They are destroying the earth, the ecosystem built by nature's marvelous mechanisms. And they always talk about how marvelous these mechanisms are, that they work so wonderfully together, and man is just destroying it. So we have environmentalism is a profane apocalyptic movement. I don't want to read this because of time and small print, but what they do, you basically take Christianity, we have judgment is coming, the millennium is coming, if you do the right thing, we have this environment of sin and their salvation if we quit doing the sinful things like against the environment. Remember Noah's Ark, the movie? Why did God destroy the world of Noah? Does anybody see that movie? Because he didn't take care of the environment. Oh, guys, you didn't see the I didn't see the movie. I just heard that. Yeah, well, we got Exodus coming up next, so I don't know what that's going to be like. But that's the basis for why God destroyed the world. That's this stuff here, see? Judgment is coming. Millennium is coming. The environment is a sin. You know, dealing with the environment in a wrong way is a sin. But there's salvation if you listen to us. There's evil in this process. There's a tribulation. The apocalyptic is coming. You always talk about the rising oceans and what's going to happen with global warming. The world's not going to be inhabitable. The people are going to die within 100 years. There won't be anybody left on Earth. But there's hope and change. We keep doing this thing like we're doing. We'll never survive. But we change things. We'll avoid the judgment. So what we have to do is repent. See, all the factors that you find in Christianity is built here. It just is perverted. Then we have forcing change. This is a former Mennonite guy from Canada. He spoke against Christian transhumanism. Now, this one hard for me to get my head around, but the best example of Christian transhumanism are the Mormons. In fact, they are kind of leading the way. In fact, there was this Carl, what's his name? Teachrib on top there, Teachrib. Carl Teachrib is giving a lecture to a hostile group, and in the back it's the Mormons, you know, for Christian transhumanism. Well, that fits because we're all becoming gods. That's Mormon theology. We are gods. We just have to grow a little bit like Jesus did. He's a little ahead of us. But it's also interesting in this movement is that they think that somehow in our technology that we're going to be able to move outside our shortcomings and move it to the higher plane through technology. So it's Christian, not again like Christian yoga, no such comparison, but it's called Christian transhumanism because it's being practiced within the Christian movement. And there's meetings together and he goes and debates these people. So this transhumanist movement, the latest incarnation of man's rebellion against God is the transhumanist movement. Many within the movement believe the singularity of humanity will lead to the emergence of post-biological humans, the bionic arm, who are able to shed their biological bodies and upgrade their hardware. I'm about ready for an upgrade. Others believe that by downloading themselves into a network, they will effectively become immortal. True believers have modified their diets, exercise regimes, and entire lifestyle in effort to increase the likelihood of living to witness human reversal of the aging process and eventual human immortality. All right. The middle one is what he kind of talked about. He talks to these groups that are doing this on a religious basis, I mean a Christian basis or spiritual basis, like the Mormons. In the realm of religion and society, phrases such as united religion, interfaith, religious pluralism, unity of diversity, global citizenship and international solidarity express the global change of culture, thought, and faith. So these events going on, we sometimes don't recognize them, but a lot of times they're just new age groups get together. And they will gather thousands and thousands of people. Now, we're so blessed to live away from that, but you go to the coasts, you know, where the populations are great. They talk about how quickly these events get sold out, you know, like internet, like within seconds, the offer that's sold out. These people go to these things and kind of like Woodstock stuff. We've seen this bumper sticker, that kind of that idea. Let's skip that. Mark Hitchcock gave his lecture on the coming four blood moons. That is another one of those so ridiculous things that these moons, actually eclipses of the moons, and they can predict them, of course. And they say, well, even this John Hagee is into this stuff. You know, he's a dispensational guy. He's been to the pre-trib conference. He's into this stuff. And so what's going to happen when the four blood moons occur? I guess there's one more to go. We don't know, but it's bad. So, you know, I was thinking, you know, I hope that, you know, I would serve them right. You know, something about February is really bad. Say, that's it. That was it. And then something much worse comes in November. Oh, shucks. We already said what it was. Now what am I going to do? So they got to pick some event in the year and say, well, that's it, because there's no event. Anyway, we got the book back there. I'm not into blood moons. I've never read the book. Another interesting guy. I wish I could tell you what he said because it's just hard to say what he said. I mean, he's a very intellectual person, and he's from Master's College in California, John MacArthur School. has been a professional geopolitical analyst for more than 20 years. He's a second-generation immigrant from Germany. Throughout his career, Matthias has held positions in foreign policy think tanks in Europe and the United States. He's also served in the military. Matthias Kern is a senior analyst for European politics in Madrid, Spain-based group that speaks Spanish. Matthias has advised senior government officials on both sides of the Atlantic on foreign policy issues. So he talks about the condition of Europe economically. He knows about that. And he knows about, talked about the population decline in Europe. And the rate of population is staggering. I mean, those countries cannot survive. And I said this to my class on Sunday. Said, you know, we worry about, I mean, some worry, whatever, about our immigration laws here. And we are inundated by the people from the South coming in here. Well, at least they're, at best, maybe Catholics or whatever, but in Europe, the immigration, there are Muslims. Much worse condition. And the Muslim, you know, you don't touch them. You can't touch them because if they do, you cut your head off. At least those guys from the South aren't doing that. So we're really kind of blessed to have immigration that is nothing like Europe, which is really, really difficult, really difficult. And that's why Turkey's not allowed into NATO, into that European alliance, because once you're allowed into the European alliance, those guys can move from border to border to border to border, and they can go anywhere they want. So that's why Turkey doesn't want, the Europe doesn't want Turkey in it. So that's one of the issues. All right. Matthias, as senior advisor, government official, both sides of the Atlantic, I think I read that, specializes in European politics as well as U.S. and European defense security related issues. He's also an analyst, essayist on the rise of Islam in the West. So very interesting guy. Wilfred Hahn, you might want to get his newsletter. It's called Eternal Values. You can just get online and get it free. He is a financial guy, knows about money, international money, and not necessarily an investment broker, but just knows about international money. So he works for banks or has worked for banks, you know, when they move money around from world to world. So he knows a lot about the economics of the world. So he was a very interesting guy to talk to. Again, one of those things that I can't explain everything he said. And then this Bill Koenig, you might see him on TV once in a while as a White House correspondent. He writes this Koenig's point of view. It's a Christian perspective. And his wife's Jewish, very effective evangelist. They don't have any children, so she's out on the street always evangelizing, and she's apparently quite effective with it. Okay, I didn't tell you everything there was there, but that's probably enough since it's 2 minutes till 8. I'll take a question if there's one on anything. I don't let you do anything you want. I'm going to go back in next year? Yeah. Can anybody go? Yep. You want to go down there and sit for 2.5 days? It's not expensive. Costs you about, well, there's a banquet in the ticket. And I think the registration is $110. So it isn't that expensive. It's staying in the hotel because you might want to find, you might be able to stay at the Motel 6 somewhere instead of the Sheraton. Yeah, it's the only place I've been going is here, and I don't know where else to go. There are some that I've seen on the West Coast, but they're like $300, $400, and you got to get there, which means fly. So, and Tommy Ice has a good job of keeping the right speakers up there. You know, he's just, 1 year they weren't very good. The early years when we went, it wasn't very good. And we said, well, I'm not sure we're going to go back. Oh, we went back one more time. Then he was back in charge of it. So that makes a difference when he lines them up or somebody else lines them up, which I won't mention who it would be. Well, there was one book, though, the predicted Lord's return would be by 2018. So we're still doing that. Not officially, you know, but you know, people come with their books. Well, they were stretching it out. You know, Hal Lindsey said 40 years, then it was 60 years, 70 years, 80 years, and now we're looking, well, 100 years. So, I mean, it's so ridiculous. No more questions? Well, that's okay. It's okay. So we went to the premillennialism I thought we're back to where we started. You know, this is really how it works, that it started out the right? The clock was set right when we started with premillennialism. They didn't call it this, but that's what it was. We believed in Jewish promises with literal hermeneutics in the times of the apostles that through the first century, maybe the first 100, maybe to 200, somewhere in there, they were premillennial because, you know, they're still close enough to the truth. And then we have church fathers start second-guessing the Jews. And when they took the Jews out of it, we gave them to this premillennial, yes, but no Jews in the premillennial. So in some sense, this becomes the historic aspect of premillennialism. We're now using allegorical interpretation for prophecy. Then we come to Augustine. We have amillennialism, allegorical, hermeneutic, allowed. Then we come to Henry VIII, historic, pro-most, and becomes postmillennialism. And we have allegorical interpretation, but we're moving back to literal hermeneutic. And we get to 1830 here with John Nelson Darby. And then we've got the dispensational premillennialism with the literal hermeneutic in the entire scripture. So that's kind of where we are now. And that's the defense that the pre-trib conference is trying to mount, is somebody's got to speak out for this. In fact, next year, they're probably on a defense of the pre-trib rapture, because there's a lot of people out there who really have that particular view in their eyesight, and they're trying to destroy it with direct attacks. So it'd be kind of good to get more ammunition in our hands for the people. It is, we talk about, it is the gateway drug, you know. It's one of those, like the five-pointer is too, to get them out of dispensationalism. Yeah, some of us doing a study on Friday morning, talking about, what day of the week it is, talking about dispensationalism. We talked about progressive, and I still don't totally have my arms around what actually progressive dispensational is, except they got things that are in the that are in the millennium, like Christ sitting on the throne already in heaven, Jesus on the throne of David in heaven. I didn't see the Allied van movers come up and move the throne, but I guess somehow it did get moved on one of the rocket shots. It's supposed to be facetious. So anyway, they got Jesus on the throne of David in heaven, which has never been there. Yes, well, I think the battle of Gog and Magog, if it is before the tribulation, which I think it is, after the rapture, which I think it is, so it's in that space of time, that if you read Ezekiel 36-39, you'll find that God says so many times, I will, I will, I will. I will what? I will show the nations something about Israel. These are my people. So yeah, I think it sets up, in a way, a last statement on God's part before he actually brings judgment down on Israel and the nations. But we won't be here to see it. In other words, I don't think we'll see the Gog and Magog, so we won't be able to say that's a fulfillment of prophecy. It still is out there unfulfilled. Well, okay, possibly. But my argument there is, we after the rapture, I think there is a realignment of the nations. Because you take out all the believers, not only of Lincoln, Nebraska, but over the entire world, and wherever you go in the world, there are believers. You take them all out in whatever position they have, there's going to be a tremendous economic, psychological, emotional impact on the world. And the humanists are going to decide, we either get together or we're doomed because we can't fight this. So I think they're talking about a crisis. Never let a crisis go to waste. There will be one. So I don't know that we can say what the conditions will be like after the rapture. All I know is that when the Gog and Magog battle occur, it says of them, they live securely in the land without bars and without walls. So I'm saying maybe it's telling me that rather than I need to look for that. That's my best answer. Other way to answer that is, You can explain by today's terms, which I don't think is fair, because if you explain things in today's terms, it will be totally different out of the rapture. So I don't even know that I want to try. But they will try. So, well, they live security in the land. And they do. I mean, you talk about Israel going to be moved out of the land. You couldn't root them out of there if the Muslim tried to run them out. I told you that. They said, we're not leaving. One, we have no place to go. There's not one nation will have us. And if we're going to die, we're going to die right here on this soil. This is our land. So they're not leaving. So in some sense, they live securely in the land. Security doesn't mean they'd live in peace. They live securely. And without bars and bars and gates, I don't know how to exactly take that. Maybe they just are in that condition at that time. I mean, anti-Semitism will be a thing of the past, at least for a moment, when the Muslims are all destroyed, the Gog and Magog, so Christians are gone. I mean, so the world finally has a chance to put itself together like it always wanted to have. that's kind of how I look at how it is. So I guess I don't feel that I have to answer exactly how it's going to be at that time, because how could I know? So I say that passage may be doing more informing me than that I need to look for those events or that condition. Maybe that's a cop-out, but no, obviously he is. I mean, okay, whoever has heard of a nation that lived without land for 15 to almost 2,000 years? It's unheard of. And there's no nation that's ever lived longer than, that's part of our study we're going to do next fall or next January, talk about how can a nation live without land? Unless God's doing something. So yeah, that in itself is a fulfillment of prophecy. Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that are fulfilled in the church age that have to do with the Jews that are not in the seventh week of Daniel, but have to do with the Jews. And even unbelievers have recognized, Mark Twain has mentioned that. So the only reason that caused me to pause is that the Jews. All right, guys and gals, you've been good again, and I thank you for your attentive audience for these 12 weeks. 12 weeks? I think it's been 12 weeks. So I'll give you, I think we have 3 weeks off. At least I hope we do, because I got to catch my breath and start reading again on another layer. So anyway, I'll pray and let you go. Lord, thank you for the evening and for the weeks we've had together this fall. Lord, for most of all, we thank you for yourself, your person that has loved us, cared for us, died on the cross for us so that we may have life and have it abundantly even this time, in this age, in this period of time which seems so difficult for so many people across the world. Thank you, Lord, for the nation we live in, for the protection that it has provided Christianity, and for the Christians that are in it that provide this wonderful place. Lord, as you tarry, give us wisdom, knowing how to deal with the adversaries that are around us. Know, Lord, that they need the gospel like anyone else. May we be about that work in a diligent fashion. Thank you, Lord, for these weeks and this church, the local place where we can gather, and for what we learn, especially what I can learn as I do the study, give wisdom again as we start another section in the winter, that we might learn greatly from the importance of the land as you've given it to Abraham and the effect of that in theology and the history of humanity. So again, thank you for the season of year we have. Bless us as we go, and make us a witness wherever we are found, ready to speak a reason for the faith that lies within us. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.